Next case up is State versus Johnson.
Good morning. May it please the court. Casey Granis representing James Johnson on appeal. I'll reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Proceed.
Mr. Johnson challenges the trial court's ER 404B ruling that admitted prior acts of sexual misconduct against two other children as evidence of a common scheme or plan. The standard of review here is abuse of discretion, but the case law makes clear that incorporated within that standard of review is the rule that in doubtful cases, the evidence should be excluded, which means that the trial court, in exercising its sound discretion, needs to exclude the evidence if it's a doubtful case. Johnson's case is one of those doubtful cases. Now, under the common scheme or plan standard...
Is there any case law that explains what a doubtful case is as opposed to a non-doubtful case?
No, they just say it. I mean, these are fact-specific determinations always, so that's probably why.
So it probably goes to the confidence of the trial court in what it's hearing about the evidence, if the trial court feels doubtful about it.
Well, still, there must be some objective component to this other than the trial court's own feeling about something. Otherwise, the legal analysis just collapses into some amorphous mush. I mean, we do have a standard.
That's not so, because, I mean, that same thing could be said, you know, about reasonable doubt, the reasonable doubt instruction. And you give the reasonable doubt instruction in some cases, and you give clear, cogent, and convincing in the other, but it's going to be up to the finder of fact when told what those things, you know, told about those two standards to decide whether the evidence is or is not clear, cogent, and convincing. So if doubtful in the context of an appellate opinion is used, it seems to me the reasonable interpretation of it is that it's directed to the trial judge who is presented with this evidence and is, you know, mulling over whether to admit it or not. Now, trial judge, is this doubtful or are you pretty confident? You know, is it more probable than not that these acts occurred and that they are similar in a material way to the facts at hand? And if the trial court feels doubtful that it's kind of far-fetched, as was found to be the case in the recent opinion from this court, then it ought to be excluded. I don't know if you know what I'm talking about. It was a case where, the prior act in a molestation case was of a younger child was the defendant saying to a teenager, you know, you shouldn't wear those revealing clothes around because it, you know, gets me excited. And that's a doubtful case. Should have been excluded.
Right.
I'm sorry, I'm getting you off track, but I couldn't let that go by.
That's okay. That's what judges do best. No, I don't want to get bogged down on this doubtful part of it. Perhaps it'd be more useful for us to focus on the legal standard for the common scheme or plan, whether the evidence as produced by the state and its offer of proof at trial met that legal standard. And the trial court identified a number of similarities between the prior acts involving the girl and the boy from approximately 9 years before the charged acts at issue here. But as we know, similarity is not enough to show the plan. The similarity needs to be substantial, needs to be marked, and there needs to be a sufficient number of those substantial marked similarities to show the plan. Now, the state's argued that, well, to establish the common scheme of plan, it's not necessary that a defendant affirmatively create the conditions at issue, the similarities at issue. And Johnson takes issue with that approach because it conflates or collapses the distinction between where a defendant devises a plan and repeats it to commit very similar crimes, which is the correct standard under common scheme. Collapses the distinction between that and opportunistic behavior. A plan to sexually abuse someone when the opportunity presents itself does not pass muster under the standard.
If what you are doing as the defendant is watching out for a particular type of opportunity, isn't that a plan? I mean, not every common scheme or plan case involves people who say to themselves, okay, now this is what I'm going to do to this child. I'm going to tell them that they can't tell anybody or I'll hurt them. That would be one paradigm of a common scheme or plan. But,
yes.
You know, getting yourself into a place where the opportunity presents itself and then perceiving, okay, if I wrestle with this little boy, you know, this is a perfect opportunity for me to molest him because it's so easy to explain to people, oh, it's just an accident. I didn't really mean to touch his genitals. And then when you realize that that worked and that you were able to get away with it, and so then the next time you see an opportunity to wrestle with a little boy, you do the same thing. Why is that not susceptible to or embraced within the word plan?
I'm going to focus on something Your Honor started with, which is this broad idea that the defendant gets himself into a situation where they can essentially prey upon the child. You know, getting yourself in that situation is what's at issue here, whether Johnson as an adolescent in regards to these two other children at issue here. Did he get himself into the situation regarding those children? I mean, this is a scenario where, you know, he's living with his parent in his home. One of the children comes over to visit. The other child, I believe, lived there for substantial periods of time. I mean, the opportunity presents itself. According to the state's evidence, Johnson took advantage of that opportunity. But as Slocum teaches, the opportunistic behavior is not enough. I mean, one of the arguments in Slocum made by the state was that, the defendant in that case, Slocum, he had a position of authority over the children, and he took advantage of that. But Slocum said, well, that's not good enough. I mean, the state argued in that case, Slocum chose when he would offend, when the children were alone or when they couldn't be seen by others what was happening. But again, Slocum said, well, that's shows opportunity. He took advantage of the opportunity, didn't show that he had devised a plan. And I asked this court to consider those factors and apply it to Johnson's case. I'll reserve some time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Stephanie Guthrie, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney for King County on behalf of the State of Washington. This court should hold that the trial court properly exercised its discretion in admitting limited evidence of two prior similar acts by Johnson. The issue here is whether there is substantial similarity. And as Judge Becker pointed out, this does not require that the defendant, that affirmative evidence of the defendant engineered each particular similarity. That would completely eviscerate the rule. As the court said in State v. Birkins, acts which in themselves or alone carry no suggestion of design or plan may, when multiplied or compared with other acts, suggest the existence of a common plan as the explanation. We infer the common plan from the similarities. We don't require proof that each similarity was itself planned before we can consider a common scheme or plan. We say, what are the odds that all of these similarities would occur in the absence of a common scheme or plan? That is the core of the doctrine.
Do you think Slocum was correctly decided?
I think, given that the trial court's findings of fact were challenged and the Court of Appeals determined as to the instances where the trial court was overruled, that was a case where the trial court's findings of fact were challenged and the court appeals found them unsupported as to several instances. Yes, I think that given that, it probably was correctly decided that you had there. The issue was not just that the defendant, was taking advantage of opportunities, as Mr. Grannis was saying. There, the issue is that there were very few, there was no similarities between some of the instances other than improper behavior with young girls. You know, one was a groping while putting lotion, sunscreen on a girl in her bathing suit. The one that was upheld was a very similar, having the child sit in the defendant's lap and then using that opportunity to molest her. And here, one of the key things here is that we have unchallenged findings of fact of numerous similarities, 8 to 10 for each of the prior instances. And those are verities on appeal. And given those, there is no abuse of discretion here. In particular, the prior instance with PPJ, where you have, you know, a child where the defendant is in a position of trust, they're alone with the child, this particular ruse of the wrestling, initiating the wrestling, and then using that to molest the child or abuse the child, and then afterwards using these psychological tactics of, oops, oh, how'd that happen? You know, that I don't know what just happened there. I mean, to deflect attention. These are all similarities the court found, that there's absolutely no abuse of discretion there. You know, even when courts, appellate courts, have found the trial court's decision to be questionable, in the words of Bacot-Garcia in the Court of Appeals opinion. As Your Honor was saying, you know, that's not the same thing as it being a doubtful case for the trial court. The Court of Appeals doesn't substitute its own decision for the trial court. And here we have so many unchallenged findings of fact of similarities.
Is there a requirement for findings of fact in this particular preliminary assessment of the evidence by the trial judge?
Is there a requirement of written findings of fact?
Yes.
No, there's no legal requirement of written findings of fact, but it certainly does make the analysis much cleaner when there are written findings of fact, as there are here.
But I'm not so sure that it would turn on whether there was substantial evidence to support the findings of fact when it seems that the decision is really a judgment. It's you know, is there substantial evidence to support that these prior acts occurred? The judgment that they're markedly similar, it is not really something that we would defer to the trial court, I don't think.
I disagree in part. I think some of these judgments about whether certain things are
defer on the basis of an abuse of discretion standard rather than examining the findings.
Right.
Because I guess what I'm saying is that it sounds to me they're more like conclusions.
I don't think they necessarily are. Some of them, I understand Your Honor's concern. But I think, you know, here a determination that, you know, an inducement was used in both instances, that's a pretty factual finding on which the court, when it's unchallenged, that's entitled to be treated as a verity on appeal. Or like the court's finding that the fear instilled.
I mean, the thing is that it's up to the jury to find that. Whether, you know, it's not a verity, if the trial court states a finding that, you know, this act occurred and it was markedly similar, then why are we even letting it go to the jury? This is a preliminary assessment of the evidence to see whether it's okay to let the jury think about it, right, in terms of the ultimate determination of guilt.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the jury is the one who's going to have to decide, as they were instructed here, whether this does establish a common scheme or plan.
It's based on an offer of proof. So it's assuming these facts to be correct. Did the trial court abuse its discretion in allowing this to go forward?
Yes. And, you know, the defendant certainly has an opportunity to ask the court to reexamine that if they think the evidence at trial comes out differently, which did not happen here.
I'm probably getting you off your track, but I was hung up on the word verity on appeal. It just doesn't seem like this is the context in which one would talk about verities on appeal.
Well, I understand the court's concern, and I think there is some merit in that concern, but I also think when you come to findings like, for example, with the prior instance with MG, the female cousin, there was a finding by the court that the defendant with both MG and the current charged victim instilled fear in that child through other instances of physical abuse or force, and that fear for both children played a role in them not reporting the abuse. That's a very specific factual finding that I think is entitled to be treated as a verity when it's unchallenged, because this court is not, I mean, yes, it was.
I mean, the only question is the court properly reciting the evidence that was presented?
But I think there is also interpretation of that evidence required.
And the
here.
Court found it to be, by a preponderance,
right,
suitable to be presented to the jury.
Yes. And I think certainly even if this court chooses to look directly at the underlying offer of proof, there's no basis here to conclude that these similarities that the trial court found were not there. Particularly, you know, I know the defendant argued in his briefing that, oh, some of these things are not similar enough, that two different kind of forms of inducement to, you know, calm yourself after the assault were not similar enough. But we saw in Keneally that macro similarities are considered. There the court cited similarities such as the fact that the acts were committed in a place or manner that went unnoticed by others, where there was a fair amount of difference. Some, they were alone together. Others, the defense hands were merely out of view of others in the room. Other macro similarities like, oh, they were all victims who were related to the defendant or lived and played close to him.
What do you mean by a macro similarity as opposed to a micro similarity?
I mean a more general similarity of, like, an inducement was used in both cases. Even though the
You mean like material similarity?
Yes, I would say so.
As opposed to a superficial similarity.
Well, or the fact that the exact details are not required to be identical for it to be considered a similarity, right? Keneally, the fact that all the abuse was committed after the victims knew or trusted the defendant, and how that trust came about was very different. You know, some it was pre-existing because of a familial relationship. Others, it was created through treats and attention. So this idea that the trial court's findings of similarities here, the fact that the defendant prevented both victims of rape from seeing his exposed penis, that might have been done through slightly different manners, but that still does constitute similarity. So in this case, the defendant has cited no case in which an appellate court has ever had this many findings, unchallenged findings of similarities, and yet found an abuse of discretion. And I think that here the trial court did not abuse its discretion. I think it probably was a little bit of a closer call as to MG than it was as to PPJ, the male victim who shared the wrestling and the oops motif. But even there, I think it was a proper exercise of the court's discretion. And I also want to point out that it is not the state's argument that of harmless error is not inconsistent here, because the trial court's decision is happening before trial, not knowing how the victim is going to testify, not knowing whether he's going to be inconsistent, not remember, or anything. In this case, it turned out he was very consistent with all of his prior statements. And certainly, you know, if this court were to find that one of the prior instances should not have been admitted, the fact that the other one was still properly admitted would have clearly removed any reasonable possibility of a different result in this case. And for that reason, this court should affirm.
At the risk of wading further into troubled waters, I'm going to do it anyway. Going back to this, doubtful cases, in doubtful cases, the evidence should be excluded, and what the focus is there. Now, Judge Becker, you referenced a case that was recently decided. I know what you're talking about. For the life of me, I can't remember what the name of it is. I think it may be Stevie Robinson, but I don't know. It was just a week or two ago.
Right.
Okay. And in that case, this court recited the standard that I'm talking about. In doubtful cases, the evidence should be excluded. And in that case, the trial court abused its discretion and committed reversible error in admitting evidence of prior acts under the common scheme or plan purpose. And it seems to me then that if this doubtful case idea is solely relevant to how the trial court is assessing the evidence, then there'd be no reason for the the appellate court to be reciting the standard at all. It would just go right for, okay, did the trial judge, you know, did the facts meet the requisite legal standard under the common scheme or plan standard? But now maybe I just, you know, maybe I just don't get it.
Well, this may fall into the category of when appellate opinions have words in them that they somehow want to work their way into the elements of a test, and I'm just resisting that because it seems to me that it's markedly similar acts under markedly similar circumstances. Did the trial court abuse its discretion in coming to the conclusion that under that test the evidence presented was substantial enough, and did the acts occur by a preponderance so that it's fair to let the jury hear about it?
Right. I did please understand where Your Honor is coming from. I think the fault line in our perspectives is that I'm looking at this, you know, doubtful case idea as being incorporated into the legal analysis, which is that if it's doubtful whether the similarities are substantial enough or marked enough, then the evidence is out. But be that as it may,
I think you see it. I mean, in your case, it's one where it seems like, you know, the trial judge was well aware of the weightiness of this opinion and of the care with which it has to be done, and which, you know, all of the leading cases, you know, DeVincentis and Lau and all of those cases say you have to be really careful with this, and that's why we want you to go through it on the record and hear it and determine it. But, you know, nevertheless, the test is clear, and the trial court is warned. Don't be blithe about this. Don't just skip through it. You know, don't think it's an unimportant test. Don't think you're going to be saved by harmless error. We need to hear how you saw this.
Yeah, just to follow up.
Because you might be doubtful once you actually hear the evidence. It might not be all that persuasive.
If I could have a moment to respond to that briefly. Johnson's argument is not an attack on the careful way in which the judge approached this issue. But even careful judges get things wrong sometimes. And in this case, that's what happened. Thank you.
Thank you. Next matter this morning will be Harper versus